You're listening to Midori House, first broadcast on the 9th of December 2013 on Monocle 24. Hello and welcome to Midori House on Monocle 24, live from Studio One here in London with me, Emma Nelson and Phil Hahn.
Coming up in the next 60 minutes, we'll be setting the day's news agenda with James Schneider, the editor of Think Africa Press. James, what do you have for us this morning?
This morning, French troops are preparing to disarm rival rebel groups in the Central African Republic. The South African Parliament is having a memorial service for Nelson Mandela, and the Catholic Church is gearing up for 24 hours of prayer to raise awareness about world hunger.
Thanks, James. Also ahead, as the Thai Prime Minister dissolves Parliament, we ask our Bangkok correspondent what happens next.
Plus, we discover the fine art of complaining and find out what makes the best whinge.
I mean, there are big debates that go on in the correspondence columns of the Tunbridge Wells Advertiser about very sort of arcane points of theology, abstinence from drink. And people get very heated about these things.
And we meet an all-female tribute band from Toronto that specialises only in playing two albums from the band Weezer. We give you Sheezer.
You know how people come up with fake band names all the time? She was just listening to it and said, hey, you know, we could make an all-girl cover band and we'd call it Sheezer. Done. Just, it had to happen.
All that plus we'll get the top stories from Budapest and a roundup of this morning's Italian front pages. Plus we may even play some music as well. That's all to come in the next hour here on Midori House.
But first let's catch up with the latest world news from Paul Osborne.
After weeks of demonstrations against her, Thailand's Prime Minister has announced she'll dissolve Parliament and call a snap election. The move follows the resignation of all opposition MPs on Sunday, and as nine large protest marches converged on Government House in Bangkok. Yingluck Shinawatra's opponents accuse her of being controlled by her exiled brother, the former Prime Minister Thaksin. She has said she's willing to talk to protesters, but has also said that what she called unlawful acts must end. Anti-government protesters in Ukraine claim that more than a million people joined a demonstration in Kiev on Sunday. They continue to demand the resignation of Viktor Yanukovych's government after he scrapped a trade deal with the European Union, favouring closer ties with Russia instead. Protesters blockaded key government buildings and toppled a statue of Lenin. Monocle's Gulliver Cragg is in Kiev.
A lot of them see the current elite in power as just a continuation of the communist elite who were in power. They say nothing really changed. Ukraine is still dominated by the Russians. More sort of mainstream liberal Ukrainian opposition supporters don't really see things that way. And a lot of them thought it was a little bit absurd to be toppling the Lenin sculpture, which is really a symbol of a different regime than President Viktor Yanukovych's.
One of North Korea's most powerful politicians has been dismissed. Jang Sung-taek is an uncle of the country's supreme leader, Kim Jong-un, but state-controlled media claim he committed criminal acts. He's held a number of senior posts in North Korea's ruling party, as well as the country's top military body. At least two people have died after a commuter train collided with a vehicle in Indonesia's capital, Jakarta. Parts of the train burst into flames. It's reported the vehicle was a truck carrying liquefied gas canisters. Rescue efforts are continuing at the scene. Police have described the first riots in Singapore for 30 years as intolerable, wanton violence. Around 400, mostly foreign workers, took to the streets, setting fire to police cars. The violence was sparked by the death of an Indian national who was hit by a bus.
When I read it, I was like, this may be fake. It was like unbelievable. I have stayed here for 14 years and enjoyed the peace and harmony. But
a lot of it has to do with the influx of foreigners which are coming in. And the situation's pretty much got out of control. I think this is the tip of the iceberg, and I think there's more to come.
I fully understand how they feel sometimes, you know. The government should work something out for the foreign workers to have a better life here.
A report says aid agencies paid the Somali militant group Al-Shabaab for access to areas it controlled during a famine 2 years ago. It says that while some charities refuse to pay the so-called registration fees, others are still paying them. In many cases, Al-Shabaab insisted on distributing the aid itself, instead keeping much of it. More than 250,000 people died in the famine. The South African Parliament meets today to pay its own tribute to Nelson Mandela. It's the start of a week of events following his death. On Tuesday, there'll be a memorial service in a stadium in Johannesburg, and more than 60 world leaders are expected to attend next Sunday's state funeral. Yesterday, there was a national day of prayers for Mr. Mandela. Another former president, Thabo Mbeki, paid tribute to him.
I'm quite certain that many of us hoped and prayed that he wouldn't die, that he would live, if not forever, but at least longer. Wanted to extend his presence among ourselves.
That's the latest news on Monocle 24.
Thanks very much, Paul. Paul will be back in about 24 minutes from now with another check of your world headlines. But in the meantime, you are listening to Midori House on Monocle 24.
London, New York, Tokyo. This is Monocle 24.
London, New York, Tokyo. Това е Monocle 24.
Лондрис, Нова Йорк, Токио.
Лондон, Нью Йорк, Токио. Dette er Monocle 24.
Londonist, New Yorkist, Tokiost, se on Monocle 24.
London, New York, Tokyo, Monocle 24 desu.
Londino, New York, Tokyo.
This is Monocle 24.
Time now on Midori House to set the day's news agenda. To help us do this, James Schneider from Think Africa Press, the editor no less, joins us in the studio once again. Welcome to the programme, James. You would think that we would start with Nelson Mandela and the commemoration for his life, which is going to happen for this week. We'll come to that in a moment because there are more urgent, pressing things happening in the Central African Republic.
Yes, the situation in the Central African Republic has been getting worse, and France is sent, it's going to end up being 1,600 troops, which is 400 more than they were going to send beforehand. And as of this morning, they've been ordered by the French Defence Ministry to start actively disarming militias as and when they find them. In an interview yesterday, the French Defence Minister said, first of all, we'll ask them nicely, and you know, then we're not going to be so nice, and we're just going to actively disarm them. And so, which is a kind of big... Whether there are enough French troops already there to have a really big impact is unsure, but it's clear that France is really amping up its efforts.
How surprising has it been just how quickly these developments seem to have moved, with the French taking the lead in this UN mandate as well? It seems like things are moving unusually quick.
Well, things look like they're moving quickly, but also they're moving pretty slowly at the same time as well. So France is able to deploy pretty much instantly what are really quite small numbers of troops. I mean, so it's going to go up to 1,600 troops. It's not really that large. And they can do that because they already have troops on a reasonably active deployment in, you know, nearby in the continent. But the move towards having a much larger UN force, and Ban Ki-moon has spoken about 9,000 troops, that's still pretty slow. It's not like that's developed now. Those troops will need to be trained, they'll need to be deployed, and they'll need to be found from different countries, and then they'll need to get the money from different countries to support it. So on the one hand, France is able to act quite quickly, but then the kind of more sustainable peacekeeping bit is still acting in a usually quite slow pace.
I mean, there's a big piece in Le Monde today about how the French are becoming increasingly involved in, Mali earlier on this year, and now we have the Central African Republic. What kind of direction is François Hollande taking his country militarily? There seems to be no hesitation when it comes to getting involved.
Well, I mean, he is trying to say that France isn't the first port of call. And he did try to say that earlier on with the Central African Republic. And there was at the back end of last week and over the weekend, there was a summit in Paris with African heads of state. And in that, Hollande was really trying to push the idea that there would be an AU, an African Union Rapid Reaction Force, that would try to deal with these security issues as and when they arise. Which is there already, but it's too small, it's insufficiently trained, and most importantly, insufficiently funded. And so Hollande said, well, you know, the UN should pay for it eventually, but the EU should pick up the slack now, and that France would do the training. So, yes, France has been ready to act. It's acted militarily four times in the last 3 years and across the continent. But at the same time, Hollande is trying to move away from the old idea of La France Afrique and trying to create more of a kind of an African face to African security architecture.
And of course, Hollande's suffering some horrendously low approval ratings domestically. Yeah. So, of course, for a politician to perhaps put the emphasis on foreign politics, it helps a little bit.
And try
bit
to
at
read
home.
Foreign papers rather than your own.
Absolutely. Yeah. Well, speaking of Hollande, he'll be one of the many of dozens of world leaders who will be in South Africa, of course, as Emma mentioned, to remember the life of Nelson Mandela.
Yes. So the whole week is, if not more, is going to be given up to memorials and reflections on the life of Nelson Mandela. It might be a bigger, in terms of world event, funeral than Pope John Paul II when it happens at the end of this week. Today, there are two kind of quite big memorial services taking place. One's in Parliament, a joint sitting where all the legislators can remember him. And then there's going to be another one in Victor Verster, what was Victor Verster Prison, which is where he was held at the end of his incarceration.
I mean, what were your thoughts on the coverage that's been granted to the life of Nelson Mandela in the last few days? I mean, the papers have been absolutely full of it. And I was just wondering how you think about the balance that's been trying to be struck between the young Nelson Mandela and then the conciliatory, peaceful, older one.
Well, I think there's been so much coverage that you can really see in it whichever bits you want to pluck out, either because they make you angry or they're what you're after. I actually think the coverage has, broadly speaking, been pretty good, in that it's, you know, as you say, it's looked at his early life, it's looked at his pre-prison life, as well as his much more known about and much more celebrated role in the negotiated transition to the end of apartheid. But also there's been some focus on South Africa's problems today and the fact that the transition hasn't ended some of the sort of structural economic aspects to apartheid. And so whilst obviously there's been some things which are a bit crass or some things which are a bit simplistic or some things which leave out other important points, because there's just so much of it, there's been some really good things, I think.
And James, finally, you've chosen another story for us, and this is about the Pope and trying to refocus some of the world's attention on global hunger.
Yes, so the Pope, who's got extremely good PR, is turning some of his...
Does that come with a job, I wonder?
You'd hope so.
Well, he's got better PR than the last guy, I think. I think he's got some real skills there. Someone should hire him. He's trying to turn the world's attention tomorrow to global hunger. He's starting a time zone around the world, global prayer. So it's an hour in each time zone. It starts in Papua New Guinea. Starts in Papua New Guinea and it goes all the way around.
We'll believe you, don't worry.
You'll believe me. Let's just say it's Papua New Guinea. I think it isn't, actually. But somewhere nearby. And he's trying to raise awareness for world hunger. The Catholic Church has a big development arm, and this Pope is trying to kind of emphasize ideas of charity and also problems of poverty and have a more pro-poor focus for the church.
Excellent stuff, James. Thanks very much for joining us on the program. James Schneider from Think Africa Press.
Coming up, we head to Italy to discuss the new leader of the Democratic Party. Stay with us.
Cityscapes have inspired filmmakers for generations, and this year we sent a film crew to the Architecture Film Festival in Rotterdam to explore common themes found in building real and imaginary worlds.
In film, you can tell what's behind the walls. You can tell about the conflicts people have, the social aspects. And as filmmakers, in essence, are interested more or less in those conflicts, you can tell what's behind the facade.
Passion, obsession, idealism, architecture on film. Now playing in the films menu on monocle.com.
It's just coming up to 9:15 a.m. in Milan, which is where we head next to get the latest from a turbulent weekend in politics. Florence's Mayor Matteo Renzi has won the leadership of Italy's biggest party, the Democrats. It makes him the key man to save the Prime Minister Enrico Letta's government.
Well, let's hear more from Monocle's Milan correspondent, Ivan Carvalho, who joins us now on the line. Welcome to the programme, Ivan. Renzi got about 68% of the vote for the leadership of the Democrat party. Will he be Italy's next Prime Minister?
Good morning, Phil. Yeah, it looks like if they go to an election, Renzi would be the man you would probably put your money on. He got they're still counting the last few votes, but he get about 1.6 million, which is about more than half a million more votes than he got just last year. If we recall, last year he was in the same race for party secretary, which he lost to Bersani. But here we are a year after, and he's now cemented his position as the next generation, the young hope for Italian politics.
You say he's the next generation and young hope. He's not that much younger than the current Prime Minister, Letta. He's, what, about 9 years younger? They both have very similar takes on where they want to take the Democrats. What do you think the prospects, the long-term prospects for the party are, given the fact that if you have two similar figures at the top, you might actually divide it rather than strengthen?
Yeah, people do discuss this in terms of, you know, Renzi applying pressure to Letta. They are from, you know, the same party. Of course, when the coalition government was formed and Enrico Letta emerged as the prime minister, one has to remember that he was made in a consensus with the center-right. As we recall, Berlusconi was part of this grand coalition government in the beginning, in the early this year, before he pulled out his parliamentarians and split and relaunched his Forza Italia party. So Letta has this sort of, while he's very popular as an individual, he's born out of this coalition where Berlusconi was engineering things. And Berlusconi was able quite craftily also to engineer Napolitano to come back as president of the republic, whereas Renzi has this, you know, massive amount of support from an electorate within the party, which I think is going to help him if the two do go head to head over certain issues. I mean, you see recently even, you know, Renzi pushing Letta on certain issues. There was a recent vote of confidence over the justice minister that Renzi's parliamentarians were pushing for to sort of bring in a new generation of a new wave of new trends on ethics, and we need to be very clear on any kind of ethical issue. So I think when push comes to shove, you know, Renzi has all that support from the base, which is going to help him.
And Ivan, of course, one of the issues that has been dogging the parliament is this electoral gridlock when it comes to the electoral reforms that are being proposed. Now that this move has happened, that Renzi's now in the top position, do you think we're going to see any movement on that deadlock?
Yeah, well, we just recently had, finally, the Constitutional Court declared unconstitutional the electoral law that was passed under Berlusconi not too long ago, the so-called Porcellum, the pigsty law, which nobody likes, because it has led to gridlock. As I mentioned before, Bersani had won just a year ago, the party secretary. He was expected to lead Italy's next government. He won but lost the election because of the electoral law's quirkiness in that it really required strange sort of coalitions and majorities, which he was unable to pull out, and so the courts threw that out because it doesn't allow the voters a choice of, you know, voting specifically for a constituent like you would say have in the UK or the US. This has been thrown out now, so there's a lot of push to by all parties to create a new electoral system. There's right now a lot of discussion about should we have a German system, a Spanish-style system. This is going to go on for the next 2 months. There's some breathing space here where parties can maneuver. I think it would probably help Italy. A lot of observers have mentioned this, that if they can get something where there's a threshold where the small parties are not allowed in, because this is something, if there's no consensus, it reverts back to a previous law in the early 90s, which would favor tiny parties. And with that would mean for Italy would be more gridlock in the future.
Ivan Carvalho, our man in Milan, thank you very much indeed for joining us. A little bit more Italian politics awaits us later in the show, where David Pleasant will join us in the studio for a look at the Italian newspapers.
You're listening to Midori House. The time is 15:19 in Bangkok. It's 8:19 here in London. But it is time to turn our attention to the Thai capital, where earlier in the day, Prime Minister Yingluck Shinawatra announced that she was dissolving parliament and calling new elections in a bid to calm the worst political crisis in the country since 2010.
More than 100,000 anti-government protesters were out on the streets of Bangkok in what they called the final showdown with Shinawatra's government. On Sunday, the country's main opposition party resigned en masse. Well, to get more on this quickly developing story, we're joined on the line by our Bangkok correspondent, Gwen Robinson. Gwen, thank you very much indeed for joining us. Just bring us the latest. Things are moving very quickly, aren't they?
Extremely quickly. I mean, it's been that way for weeks now, but I think the tempo has picked up significantly in the last 24 hours, not least to find that after signalling very firmly that she would not step down for the last couple of weeks, we woke up this morning to find Yingluck prepared to dissolve parliament and call a snap election, which was one of the options, but I think most people have not expected this to come quite so soon.
But we haven't heard when these new elections are going to be proposed for. So do you think this will do enough to calm these protests that are still on the streets of Bangkok?
Well, you know, that's a very good question, and there's a lot of different opinions about that. Some of the protesters that have been interviewed, and I've seen a range of them, quite a few are saying this is not enough. You know, they want a complete erasure of the whole Thaksin ethos from the country's political life, Thaksin being the disgraced former prime minister, living in exile now, the older brother of Yingluck, the prime minister. And the whole trigger for these protests was a bill that, an ill-fated bill that Yingluck and her ruling party tried to push through parliament to absolve political, those charged with political crimes, including, of course, her brother. And the notion that it would pave the way for his return angered protesters. Also, the notion that the bill would absolve people previously responsible for deaths of protesters in 2010. So, you know, clearly the Thaksin connection is a problem for Yingluck, but let's not forget that this is only in the capital, the very middle-class urban centre, where it's full of protesters that are supporting the Democrat opposition, which was once in power in 2010. But outside, in the countryside, you've got a vast mass of farmers, rural poor. They still love Thaksin, and they will still vote for the current ruling party.
Gwen, that was just one of the questions I wanted to ask, is do you think there's a concern here that across the country they could be setting up this dangerous divide between the middle class in the big metropolitan areas and then the rural poor?
Well, absolutely. It's been that way for some time. And I know a lot of Thai commentators get annoyed at the tendency, say, of Western media to oversimplify all this into a us and them, you know, middle class versus rural poor. However, you know, there's no denying it. The gap, you know, the income equality gap, I think, is as big as it ever was, if not greater. Household debt is rising. Farmers, apart from those benefiting from some populist policies of the Yingluck government, such as rice subsidies, but overall, you know, there is a big gap. And it does, this whole thing has reinforced, I think, that gap with, you know, very affluent protesters for the first time in a long time out on the streets. You know, I've never seen this number of office workers, housewives, students out there with their, you know, mobile phones and sophisticated equipment, you know, snapping photos and posting them on Facebook and Twitter and like that. This is very unusual. In the past, it's always been this rural and urban poor coming in by bus from the countryside to protest. So I personally think it is reinforcing these divisions in Thai society. How that would play out in elections really remains to be seen, because, you know, you don't have much of the Bangkok sophistication out there, even though there is a growth now of regional cities and they are coming up economically. I think the vast voter base is still, you know, your classic rural peasant or, you know, labourer.
Gwen Robinson, thank you very much indeed for joining us on the line from Bangkok.
You're listening to Midori House with me, Phil Hahn, and Emma Nelson. It is 8:24 here in London and 9:24 in the morning in Budapest, where we are going to head to next to speak to our man there, Adam Labor. Adam, welcome to the program. Shall we begin on the NSA spying bugging scandal, which continues to engulf much of the world, including Hungary?
Yes. One of the things that's interesting about the NSA scandal is how it's rippling around different countries, as you say, and it's a sort of slightly secondary story beyond all the news about the internet companies, as we saw this morning, like Google and Yahoo calling for greater transparency, is that smaller countries are very indignant about this. They find that according to WikiLeaks documents or some of the stuff that Edward Snowden's been has released, that they've been targeted, and they thought that they were friends of America, and now it seems that America has supposedly been listening in on them, and there's a lot of anger about that here.
It's a two-pronged investigation, isn't it? As you say, Adam, it is an investigation as to whether anybody from the Hungarian political sphere had been targeted and had been tapped, but also to what degree Hungary's intelligence service might have been involved in all this.
Yes, and that's always the big question as to how much involvement there is of the domestic intelligence services. Are they making secret deals with the Americans behind the scenes, or are they even, not even making a deal, just kind of tipping the wink? There's a lot of politics around the intelligence services here, because many people see them as a kind of hangover from the communist era, and there is some continuity, I think, in the staff between the people who are running the intelligence services under the old system and now, although obviously less because it is more than 20 years since the change. But generally, the government here, which is a right-wing government, does regard the intelligence service as being a bit of a den of old communists and who have some questionable connections. So they're always quite happy to have a chance to attack or criticize the communists, and who they believe are still involved in the intelligence services.
And Adam, you have another story for us. It's a topic that we've covered quite a bit here with you on Midori House over the past few months, and that was, of course, concerns over the government's power grab, so to speak. But it seems like now the judges are starting to weigh in on this discussion.
Yes, a very interesting episode happened last week. There was a woman who was allegedly has killed four people while driving her car drunk, a BMW X5 at around 160 miles an hour, tragically plowed into another car, and everyone in the other car was killed. And the woman was provisionally given a sentence of 6 years, some of which, many people thought that was very short, and in the kind of the holding period between starting her sentence was allowed to be under house arrest. Now, a man called Antal Rogan, who's the head of the Fidesz parliamentary faction and also the mayor of District 5 in Budapest, which encompasses parliament and downtown, so a very powerful figure, actually went and made a video and posted it on his Facebook page saying how outrageous it was that this woman was merely under house arrest, and she was under house arrest in an apartment block with a swimming pool and a sauna and in very comfortable conditions. And this caused a big fuss because the judges are saying, and I think I tend to side with the judges here, that really powerful politicians shouldn't be interfering in the democratic process here, especially not making videos about how outrageous, judicial decisions are. Whereas Mr. Rogan says it's a free country, anyone can say whatever they want. And that is it's true, but I think in most democracies, you wouldn't find the head of the parliamentary ruling party making a video commenting on a specific case and giving specific opinions about what the judges have done wrong. So I think most people think he's crossed some kind of line here.
To what degree do you think that, the Hungarian judicial process is subject to influence from the executive when perhaps it shouldn't be?
Well, that's a very complicated question. I mean, I think on a day-to-day basis, I don't think that the government's saying to judges do this and do that. And there is the judicial system is independent here, but nonetheless, there have been concerns expressed by the European Union and also by the State Department in America about the independence of the judicial system, because one of the key people running it is a woman called Tunde Hando, who's kind of running the executive side of things, not the judicial side. And she is the wife of a Fidesz MEP called Jozsef Szájer, who wrote the constitution, the new constitution. Now, of course, you can say she's a completely independent person and, you know, she has the right to pursue her own career. But there have been concerns about the way that she runs the judicial system and, in particular, the placing of court cases. You know, some critics say that she places contentious cases outside Budapest with judges that might be more likely to be sympathetic to the government. She, of course, flatly denies all of that. But there are concerns about this. It is an issue.
Adam Labor in Budapest, thank you very much indeed. You're listening to Midori House on Monocle 24.
Lots more to come in the second half of the program, including a look at the art of complaining. We'll explain what that means in just a little bit. And of course, there's Sheezer, the all-female Weezer tribute band from Toronto.
You know how people come up with fake band names all the time? She was just listening to it and said, hey, you know, we could make an all-girl cover band and we'd call it Sheezer. Done. Just, it had to happen.
Of course it does. It just has to happen. Has to happen. There's some inevitable things in life.
Before, though...
One of them.
The news headlines with Paul Osborne.
Authorities in Thailand say snap elections are due to be held at the beginning of February. The country's prime minister has announced that she'll dissolve parliament after sustained demonstrations against Yingluck Shinawatra's administration. The move followed the resignation of all opposition MPs on Sunday and came as 9 large protest marches were due to converge on Government House in Bangkok. Anti-government protesters in Ukraine have claimed that more than 1 million people joined a demonstration in Kiev on Sunday against Viktor Yanukovych's government. It's after he scrapped a trade deal with the European Union, favouring closer ties with Russia instead. Protesters blockaded key government buildings and toppled a statue of Lenin. One of North Korea's most powerful politicians has been dismissed. Jang Sung-taek is an uncle of the country's supreme leader. State-controlled media claim he committed criminal acts. Police in Singapore say the first riots there for 30 years were intolerable. Around 400 mostly foreign workers took to the streets, setting fire to police cars in violence sparked by the death of an Indian national hit by a bus. And the South African Parliament will meet today to pay its own tribute to Nelson Mandela. It's the start of a week of events after his death. On Tuesday, there'll be a special memorial service at a stadium in Johannesburg. And more than 60 world leaders have now said they'll attend next Sunday's state funeral. And those are the latest headlines on Monocle 24.
Thanks very much, Paul. We'll be back at 9 a.m. London time, just about 28 minutes from now, with another check of your world headlines. But you're back with Midori House here on Monocle 24 with me, Phil Hahn, and Emma Nelson. Now, this week's Cultures, taking a look at the weird and wonderful world of the tribute band, from an Argentinian Freddie Mercury impersonator to a ball-breaking AC/DC act from Italy.
It makes your eyes water just thinking about it. In this report, however, we head to Canada to meet some rather special ladies. They're making their mark on this often male macho-dominated market. So if you have a soft spot for mid-90s college rock, Phil?
I know you do.
Then we think they might just be for you. Or for me, apparently.
Yeah. Sheezer, that's the all-female Weezer tribute band from Toronto. Well, they specialize in only playing the first 2 albums from the band and have gathered an enthusiastic fan base in the 4 years since they were founded.
Gosh, I bet they don't change their set very much. They've been rocking Eastern Canada since 2009. Marcella's went to meet them.
We're not actually trying to be members of the band, especially since we rotate the singing duties. So 3 out of 4 of us are Rivers at any given time.
Laura Barrett, bass player and founding member on The Origins of Sheezer.
Dana is the drummer. We were traveling back to Toronto from Pop Montreal, I think, and listening to Pinkerton pretty much on repeat. It was a tradition in the van. And Dana, you know how people come up with fake band names all the time? She was just listening to it and said, hey, you know, we could make an all-girl cover band and we'd call it Sheezer. Done. Just, it had to happen. That was really it. It was just a band name and a concept that said it all. We had a MySpace before we had a gig.
Jimmy,
The biggest Weezer fan in our band is Robin. She has seen them, I think, 3 or 4 times. Lish comes second, maybe. Dana and I, we're into Weezer. I mean, I really like the music of Weezer. I personally have never seen them play live. I can't afford to nowadays, for sure.
Did you find your relationship to Weezer change when you started playing their music rather than just being a fan?
Well, yes, because especially for me, I was learning a new instrument. So learning how to play bass only with exclusively Matt Sharp's bass licks is a really fascinating exercise, and it's a great experience for getting into the style of something. I felt like it was like piano lessons where you focus on a certain composer. And so instead of Bach studies, I was doing Matt Sharp etudes or something.
Is Weezer aware that you exist?
Yes, Weezer knows about us, or at least Rivers does. I don't know if he sent out a bulletin to the rest of the band, but he actually tweeted at us, and I'm not sure how he initially found out. It could have been a friend of Lish's who, I think it was also before we had played a single gig, so he tweeted at us and he said something like, "Ladies and gentlemen, she's her," and so we got the Rivers bump. Like, it was, we had hundreds of fans after that. The touring has been really exciting. We went out west opening for Born Ruffians and got to play a lot of large venues to crowds that, because Born Ruffians are so popular, it widened our audience and our reach. And it got a lot of women and girls at those shows seeing women playing rock instruments, which I didn't think was such a huge deal, but they would come up to us afterward and say, like, "Oh, now I know that, oh, you know, this is a surprise," basically, is what they were saying. It was a pleasant surprise for them, or, you know, girls really can rock, which is kind of a terrible thing to hear.
Is there a difference between a cover band and a tribute band?
Big, big difference between a cover band and a tribute band. Cover bands generally take somebody's music and reinterpret it in their own style. But a tribute band plays everything note for note, and that's what we're going for. So we're a tribute band.
And finally, what does the future hold for Sheezer?
Well, we are playing at least one Toronto gig in the next few months, but things are always hard to predict with us because of the other projects people are involved in. We do make plans. I would really like to do some American touring. I think we'd do really well in the States.
Mark Salazar reporting for this week's tribute band-themed culture show that airs at 1900 hours London time today.
You are listening to Midori House. We'll be back right after this with a look at the fine art of complaining.
In Istanbul, they took to the streets in a battle for green space. In Sao Paulo, they marched in their thousands in a fight for cheaper buses. In Athens, they shouted loud to demand a better-run capital. And every week in London, there's a rollerblading convoy that reclaims the streets for the pedestrians and pedal pushers. That's why urbanism matters, why words like density, infrastructure, and smart cities need to be dragged out of city hall conclaves and turned into a public debate. And that's why every week Monocle's show, The Urbanist, reports from cities around the world that are getting horribly wrong and deliciously right, visits the mavericks and mayors with a vision further than the edge of their desk, and asks the questions that will shape how we live tomorrow.
To me, placemaking is a sacred community process. It's about an organic way that communities can evolve and shape the spaces that are important to them.
Every 20 years, the city gets rebuilt. There's probably not a lot of cities in the world that gets rebuilt every 20 years.
People respond to variety, and cities need a richness and diversity.
Oh, and we take time to savour the softer side of metropolitan living too, from the need for playfulness to places to pause in the melee. Presented by me, Andrew Tuck, The Urbanist premieres every Thursday at 1900 London time, and you can also download it from monocle.com or iTunes.
Monocle 24 is your 24-hour-a-day international radio service. Based in the heart of London, with contributions from our bureau in Hong Kong, Tokyo, New York, Toronto and Zurich, and reporters in more than 30 countries, we broadcast a mix of news, discussion, features, reportage, reviews, music and more. From retail to travel, food to urbanism, business to film, Monocle 24 has it covered.
One of the things that I would like to allude to, which is very much the kind of thing that you're doing here, is you're having this kind of discussion. But the discussion that needs to take place, where the forward thinking needs to come from, is from the brains trusts and the think tanks, and they're not doing it.
To call it an international conference, that's difficult in itself. The really difficult thing is then to start to implement the conclusions.
I was actually the last correspondent to send dispatches by carrier pigeon. It's not something I'm proud of.
There are two kind of games. The games that uses the city, and the other kind is the city that uses the games.
Plus, our carefully curated playlist is the soundtrack to your day, stretching from Stockholm to Sydney, Brooklyn to Bogota.
It was like entering the gates of heaven.
You can hear us live at monocle.com, catch up with anything you may have missed on our Time Shift player, download our bespoke app for your smartphone, and hear it all on iTunes.
I like the sense that you just have no idea where it's going to go.
Monocle 24, keeping an eye and an ear on the world.
Welcome back. You're listening to Midori House. The time here in London is 8:41 on a Monday morning. Now, Tunbridge Wells, a town in the southeast of England, is synonymous with the fine art of complaining, believe it or not. There's even an expression called Outraged of Tunbridge Wells. Well, the phrase came from the 1950s when readers sent their letters to the Tunbridge Wells advertiser paper, rather.
Well, the journalist, so intrigued by this example of parochial discontent, decided to go through the archives and search for the best complaints. They range from cocks crowing, problem I have all the time, and Christmas caroling nuisances, which just sounds far more interesting than it possibly could be. Monocle's Fernando Augusto Pacheco met Nigel in the Monocle studios to talk about Nigel's book. It is called Outraged of Tunbridge Wells.
Tunbridge Wells is an old spa town in rural Kent. That's in the southeast of England. But it became rather posh later when the railways reached out there, and it became a commuter town for gentlemen who worked in the City of London. So Tunbridge Wells is a kind of quintessential English town, the sort of place that Agatha Christie might be found, or even P.G. Woodhouse might be wandering around. They were very famous for their letters to the Daily Telegraph, often complaining about the railways, the commuter service, or any other matter under the sun.
And have you been to the town many times to do research for the book?
I've not been recently. I did go there as a child. My grandmother lived there. I did all the research for the book in North London. The British Library have a massive newspaper library in Colindale, which is a rather strange suburb. It looks somewhere like a place out of a small town of Mussolini's Italy. But there's a massive archive of newspapers that go back as far as our Civil War in the 17th century. Up there, there were all newspapers in this country, books, for copyright reasons, have to be registered with the British Library. So they have a collection of the local newspaper in Tunbridge Wells that goes back to the middle of the 19th century. My son and I went up there, and we just trawled through from the beginning of the newspaper up until it died the death in 1958. So we went through them all and picked out letters that we thought were funny.
And I have to say, there are a lot of funny ones. And I would like you, if that's okay for you, shall we read one of them? Just then our listeners will have a taste of the book.
Okay. This one begins, "Sir, now that lighter mornings are before us, may I remind your readers who keep poultry that cockcrowing at dawn in the neighbour of houses, especially in the town, constitutes a nuisance and a very real annoyance to many people. The owner of a dog that barks all night is liable to be summoned, but the owner of a cock that crows unceasingly from 2:30 a.m. overlooks the fact that he's a far greater nuisance."
Well,
and it is signed "A Light Sleeper." It is from April the 16th, 1915. There was a war on. They were more worried about cocks crowing.
That's brilliant. It's like, do you think there's an art, the way you complain, almost?
I think there is. I think there's a particular sort of Englishness about this sort of complaint. Especially, as I say, there's a war going on at the time. They're not worried about big, important things like... In fact, the Tunbridge Wells, being to the southeast of England, was actually bombed during World War I by Zeppelins, but they were more worried about the cocks crowing.
I mean, at that time, they still complain, but now they have other forms of doing that. They do that on social media. But do you think there's still like the most traditional ones that still complain to the papers? Is that something that still exists?
Well, they do complain to the national newspapers. Unfortunately, then very, very few of these local newspapers left. But I suppose this is the Twitter of its era.
I believe so. And have you ever complained yourself?
Me? I complain in restaurants sometimes. The London newspaper, the Evening Standard, often email me and ask me to complain about things, and I duly do, yes.
Just if you can tell us other anecdotes. I mean, what other things that make people very angry that you mention in the book and that can be quite surprising?
You can imagine that in a small town, they're busy, that they're worrying about women pushing prams on the street, or indeed women getting on the buses at the time of day that a gentleman's coming home for his dinner, so the buses are full. And there's all the old complaints about noisy children. Mixed bathing comes in.
Ooh,
very shocking, very shocking idea.
Super shocking.
and rowdiness at cricket matches and all, you know, all sorts of disturbances like that.
So maybe I think the British, and especially the people from Tunbridge Wells, they just like to complain. It's the way of showing the creativity somehow as well, the way they complain as well.
I suppose they do that. I mean, there are big debates that go on in the correspondence columns of the Tunbridge Wells Advertiser about very sort of arcane points of theology, abstinence from drink. And they people get very heated about these things. They pass us by now. But this book and collecting these letters and just presenting them naked for the reader takes you back into this past time that's as I say, that belongs to Miss Marple, Jeeves and Wooster.
Almost very innocent somehow as well.
Yes, it is. It is very innocent.
And that was journalist Nigel Cawthorn there with Monocle's Fernando Augusto Pacheco having a good old English whinge.
It was a moment of quintessential Englishness there on Monocle 24. Complaints about cricket matches. Really.
And mixed bathing ponds.
I still have thoughts about that already, Mr. Hahn. I don't know. A long lost lament to the complaint. You're listening to Monocle 24.
The perfect way to start the day on the East Coast or in Latin America, your lunchtime catch-up in Europe, The Briefing is Monocle 24's fast-paced news and business show, bringing you up to speed with all the day's biggest stories.
It is absolutely vast. It's palatial in its proportions, this building, and it really reflects just how important the role of Mayor of Paris is.
Monocle's team of in-house experts bring you all the latest news on media and aviation, defence and technology, while an editor is on hand to run through the morning's front pages from Bogota to Boston.
You have all these people scrambling, you have all these investigators involved, and we still don't have a clear reason as to why these batteries did what they did.
My feeling is that politicians eat and try to enrich themselves and tax us.
That's The Briefing, every weekday at midday in London and 7 a.m. in New York, in association with BlackBerry.
Welcome back to Midori House with Phil Hahn and Emma Nelson, where the time is 8:49 a.m. here in London. We head to Italy in a moment to review the Italian papers with our man David Pleasant. Let's turn now to a lady who's terribly famous in Italy, though. This is Anna Maria Quaini, or Mina Mazzini, one of the most successful Italian singers of all time, also known as Mina. From 1963, this is the song Città Vuota. It's a lonely town.
Strade piene, la folla intorno a me, mi parla e ride e nulla sa di te. Io vedo intorno a me chi passa e va, ma so che la città vuota mi sembrerà. Se non torni tu, c'è chi ogni sera mi vuole accanto a sé, ma non mi importa se i suoi baci mi darà. Io penso sempre a te. Mi sembrerà, se non torni tu. Senza te leggo il tuo nome ovunque intorno a me. Torna da me, amore, non sarà più vuota la città e io vivrò con te tutti i miei giorni.
Mina there with the song Città Vuota.
Well, you are indeed listening to Midori House with me, Phil Hahn, and Emma Nelson. I'm delighted to say we're joined here in the studio by a very special guest, Monocle's David Pleasant. Welcome to the programme, David. Lovely to see you as always.
Nice to see you, Phil.
Did you have a good weekend? Did you enjoy the Monocle Christmas market?
Oh, it was lovely, yeah.
What
really
role
nice.
Did you have? What were you doing?
I was actually looking after the tombola, but you know what? We ran out of tombola tickets because it was so popular.
I know, they kept putting them in. I went to have a go and they were like, wait. And they filled the tombola with tickets before I had a go. And I just thought, that's really unfair.
Well, it was so popular.
The person in front of me would have had a much higher chance of winning something than me. He had to wade through handfuls of wrong tickets.
There were some good prizes, though.
There
were some
good prizes.
Never saw them. Too many tickets in my tombola.
Someone's a little bit bitter.
Possibly. No, not at all bitter. No, it all goes to a nice charity.
Well, earlier in the programme, David, we were discussing, of course, Renzi winning the leadership of the Democratic Party there in Italy. I'm guessing it's dominating all the front pages on the papers today as well?
Yeah, I mean, all the papers are leading with that. And, I mean, it's just extraordinary what a huge story this has been and kind of the build-up to this. Renzi's been this kind of... Everyone's had their eye on him for about a year now, since the elections and the general elections, which he didn't actually take part in, but was kind of meant to be. And anyway, it's all come to this this conclusion. And so, I mean, it'll be interesting to see how he'll kind of follow up with all the expectations that there are of him. But
he has this whole idea about wanting to instigate a generational change. I mean, he's youthful. He's, what, only 38? And he's made a real impact on Florence. But he also wants to target a sort of mindset that he accuses older politicians' insistence on stability is actually being an excuse for letting the country go to rack and ruin. How seriously do you think people are going to take this?
Well, I think very seriously, because I think it's got to the point that people, I mean, and it's interesting that he won overwhelmingly. I mean, something like 68% of the vote of the party itself. And that was always the problem of whether he'd be able to convince the centre-left itself. And he obviously has done that. The people in poll ratings, he's immensely popular. So I don't think he's got much convincing to do of the actual Italian people. He's managed to convince the party. So I think he's kind of basically got open access to do whatever he likes, it seems.
David, let's move on to another story which you've got for us. Of course, I remember last month we were covering this on the 6th of November. The House of Gladiators, that historic site in Pompeii, collapsed. But now it looks like some heads are going to have to roll there in Pompeii.
Exactly. What's extraordinary about this is just how this story is from La Stampa. There's the process of choosing, nominating the superintendent of the site, which you wouldn't think was a tremendously important role. But this is, I mean, it's kind of got a lot of attention. There's various people are kind of in the running, and the Minister of Culture is having to make his decision today, apparently. And this piece just kind of goes through some of the candidates, and there's some really kind of high level people, anti-corruption police, one person, Umberto Postiglione, who kind of cut his teeth in Palermo fighting the mafia there. You wouldn't think that was necessary to. You might want to go for an archaeologist, perhaps.
Yes. But I was going to ask you that, David. But you seem to have answered your own question. I mean, do you really need to protect the crumbling walls of Pompeii from the Casa Nostra?
Well, you do, I think, because this piece actually says that there's a 105 million euro budget that's been set aside for the restoration of the project. And this Pompeii is in Naples, around, you know, there's Camorra, that the local mafia has had immense influence and bad effect in terms of the environment and various pollution scandals. So it seems only right that they're looking for that kind of figure.
And of course, this role of a superintendent to manage these historic sites was brought in back in July of 2008, when there was some concern over the state of the ruins there. But now, after this collapse of the historic Gladiator House, and you know, the culture minister just saying earlier this year that Pompeii is finally saved, lots of reputations are on the line, aren't they?
Exactly. It's, I mean, the public opinion surrounding this is really huge. I mean, it's kind of thought of as a national scandal, and quite rightly so, that one of Italy's prime archaeological and cultural sites is in such disrepair. What's quite interesting is there's more mention, the Colosseum recently appointed a head that came from UniCredit, one of the biggest banks in Italy. So some people are thinking that you should go for more of a financial role, more of a kind of money man. So who knows, that there are various candidates listed. So we will find out shortly who will.
It's funny, I mean, just briefly touching on that, every time I go to Rome, I'm absolutely astonished about how badly treated their ruins are. You just clamber over them. And you think that if we were anywhere else in the world, someone would, you know, either make you pay to go in or just at least discreetly put a fence around it. Pompeii, it appears to have been completely neglected.
Well, I wouldn't say completely neglected. I think the problem is also the sheer size and scale of these sites, and just the number of them, and how diffused they are all over Italy, and makes it very hard to manage. There was a recent exhibition in London, and I actually met the director of that, and he said that he's always found the people in Pompeii, the archaeologists, like fantastic people. It's that a bit overwhelmed. That's kind of the problem.
Yeah, they do have an awful lot to preserve. Plus the fact that if you in a country which has political stability and no money, what are you going to get? It's all going to fall to bits. David Pleasant, thank you very much indeed for today's review of the morning papers.
Hopefully the site will still be around. I've never been, but I'd love to go.
Beautiful.
Go. Yeah, you should perfect. Go. Something special. That's all we have time for today's programme. Our thanks to our producer Danny Giacopelli and our researchers Fernando Augusto Pacheco and Luis Mendoza. Our studio manager too, Alex Funnell. Up next after the news is The Urbanist, at Monocle's programme dedicated to the cities we live in. Stay tuned for the briefing at midday in London, 7 a.m. New York time.
I'll be back with Dominic Reynolds for another edition of Midori House at the same time tomorrow. But for now, from me, Phil Hahn.
And from me, Emma Nelson. Thanks for listening and goodbye.
Why this watch? This watch is a witness. A witness to words that moved nations. Its dead men faster, further. It's been worn by luminaries, visionaries, champions. It doesn't just tell time. It tells history. Rolex.